The damage is far greater here than with Christopher Keyes. Jackman grunted. That's what I thought. Which is yet another puzzle. He looked around. No Ella Jarvis tonight?
Sorry, sir. I'm the only one who is free to attend. She's already committed to another incident in Greenborough. We're thin on the ground this evening, so I'm photographer, socco and pathologist.
That sounds like the deep end, Spike, said Marie.
I'm not complaining, Sergeant. I like the variety.
He looked up at Jackman.
I won't be able to tell you much until first light, I'm afraid, especially where the shot came from, but I'll make it my priority.
One favour? Asked Jackman.
The bag. Could you check it to see if there's any ID in it? And his pockets too. We need to know who this man is.
Give me a minute to photograph the body in situ, then I'll check it out, no problem.
His minute seemed to take forever.
While they waited, Marie mulled over the possible reasons for the man having a gun in his possession. It could have been a souvenir, or he was going to sell it. In which case, why was it loaded? Protection seemed most likely. Protection from what? Or rather, who?
Gary had gone back to sit with Kevin. Marie and Jackman remained waiting for Spike to open the rucksack. Marie noted with amusement that Jackman had omitted to tell Spike about his premature glance into the bag. He had said nothing about the handgun. Crime scene contamination was a massive source of dispute between forensics officers and detectives. She herself had witnessed even high-ranking officers receive a tongue-lashing from an exasperated socco. Finally, Spike turned his attention to the bag. He felt around inside it.
Oh, I was expecting a few precious items from his previous life, fags and maybe a bottle of cider, but not this.
Spike drew out the gun and placed it straight into an evidence bag.
Is it loaded? Asked Jackman, all innocence. It is, as I'm sure you know, sir.
Spike threw Jackman a wry smile.
The flap on this bag has been lifted, after the blood had sprayed across it. The spatter pattern is slightly out of alignment. Nice try, but the prof warned me about what might happen if you got here first.
Jackman threw up his hands.
Good old Rory, okay, I'll cough, but I only glanced inside, so I do need to know about anything that could ID him.
Spike checked through the contents and shook his head.
Sorry, sir, there's nothing. The gun will be the first place to start. If it's licensed, you can trace the owner, and even if it isn't, you can check back to its original provenance. I'll ring you with the serial number as soon as I get it back to the lab.
Jackman stared down at the unfortunate victim.
Pockets. Can you check them too, Spike?
Marie expected nothing, and that's exactly what Spike found. The fact that the gun is still loaded is a bit disconcerting, Spike. Is there a safety catch?
Not on one of these, he smiled at her. But don't worry. They have built-in safety features to stop the gun accidentally discharging. Even if it's dropped, it's perfectly safe. In the right hands.
The right hands. Marie wondered about Barney. Did he have the right hands? Was it his gun, or had he stolen it? They'd already had one theft of a gun only hours ago. This could have been obtained in the same way. Jackman's voice reached her as if from a distance.
We should leave Spike to work.
As they walked towards the ambulance, Marie could not help looking around to try and ascertain where the sniper had concealed himself. Spike had been right. That would have to wait until after daybreak. Uniform had already established a large perimeter area, excluding anyone other than emergency service personnel and extending beyond the waste ground.
I'm thinking another trip to our local gun expert, Kenneth Harcourt, should be lined up for tomorrow, said Marie.
First thing, never fear. And if this gun has the slightest connection to that man, I'm bringing him in for questioning,
Jackman assured her.
I'd call on him tonight, but I think we need to run the checks on the serial number first. I have to know who the dead man is.
Might come down to dental records if all else fails. I did notice his teeth were good, so he must have been receiving regular treatment, at least until recently.
She looked across to the ambulance.
Kevin looks like shit, sir. Has he got anybody at home, or does he still live alone?
I believe he's in a relationship, but I get the feeling they don't live together.
Jackman moved ahead of her.
I'll check. It's not a good idea for him to go home to an empty house after what he's just witnessed.
Kevin said he had phoned his friend Alan, who was coming to pick him up.
"You'll stay with me tonight, sir. I'll be fine after a hot shower and a large drink. It was just a shock of it. One moment William and I were chatting, then..."
His voice trailed off and he shook his head as if trying to rid himself of the memory.
"You want a full statement, sir? Shall we go to the station before going home?"
"Tomorrow, Kevin. As soon as your friend gets here, off you go, understand? The statement can wait." Jackman squeezed Kevin's shoulder. "And try to get some sleep."
Marie saw someone waving from the other side of the cordon.
"I think Alan is here, Kevin."
Kevin stood up, unwrapped the foil blanket and gave them a faint smile.
"I'll get off then. See you tomorrow."
Marie watched him join a tall, slim man with blonde, almost white hair and an anxious expression. Not the best way to bow out from his time as a uniformed officer. As from next week, he would be helping them track the sniper as a detective constable.
"We should get away too," Jackman said.
"Uniform have got this all under control, and the sorcerer's apprentice is reveling in his new role as ballistics trauma specialist. There's nothing more we can do here. We are going to need our wits about us tomorrow, so try and grab some rest. We can't keep this one out of the press, unfortunately. The cack is really going to hit the fan when the public hears about it and armed officers appear on the streets.
Ruth is going to have to give one of her famous tight-lipped speeches to the media, where she talks a lot and says nothing," Marie said.
"Damned if I could do it," muttered Jackman.
"So far, the press has been told that we're dealing with an incident," said Gary. "No details as yet. What scares me is the speed our shooter is working at. 2 deaths in 1 day. Does he have a list? Is he picking off specific targets? Or maybe they were just like little ducks on a fence, random victims who walked into the crosshairs."
They had reached their cars. "We have a lot of work to do to find out, Gary." Jackman paused, looking at them intently. "Guys, don't let this blind you to the fact that Alistair Ashcroft is still waiting in the wings. Don't drop your guard for a second, and please watch each other's backs."
Murray smiled at him.
"Believe me, I'm not about to forget Ashcroft, and the warning goes for you too, sir. You take care of yourself."
Marie watched the taillights of Jackman's car disappear. He was looking gaunt again, older, exactly like the last time Ashcroft appeared on the scene. Where was that trademark steely look in his eyes?
"Come on, Sarge," Gary said. "Let's go home and get ourselves a nightcap. I brought a bottle of Jameson's Irish whiskey with me. It was my late sister's favourite tipple, and I'm beginning to understand why."
"Good idea. I've had enough of today."
In a narrow lay-by on the outskirts of one of the Salton villages, 2 shadowy figures stepped down from an old Land Rover. They had not exactly covered themselves in glory on their last 2 exploits, so tonight they were determined to get it right. It shouldn't be difficult, really.
"Okay. Ready?"
Noah asked his brother.
"Suppose,"
Jacob mumbled. They climbed over a low fence, and keeping close to the edge of the field, arrived at a 5-barred gate. They stopped and listened. All was quiet in the yard beyond. They knew there were a couple of sensor lights around the stables, but they had been observing the place and knew that there were several areas these didn't cover.
"Good luck, bro."
Noah pushed him forward.
"This is your thing, so get on with it."
Jacob looked a lot less confident than his older brother. Noah slowly swung the gate open and wedged it back. Once he was through, Jacob moved along the block of stables until he found the one he was looking for. He raised a hand to Noah and slipped in through the half door. Noah held his breath, hoping the horse wouldn't get spooked. It seemed to take forever until Jacob emerged from the stall, leading the animal across the yard towards him. He had placed a soft bridle over his head, and the magnificent horse was ambling behind him like a favourite pony. Once they were through the gate, Noah secured it again and followed his brother and the horse back across the fields.
"There's an entrance a bit further down. I'm not risking jumping that fence we came over," whispered Jacob. Go back to the car and get home. We'll see you there.
Noah nodded and watched as his brother swung easily onto the horse's back and with a click urged it forward. He allowed himself a sigh of relief. Apart from the odd whinny and a few snorts, the handsome beast had been as docile as a lamb. Barring any accidents before they reached home, it looked like they had actually pulled something off for once. Noah, too, was hoping the family would be pleased this time. He was fed up with being labelled a clueless moron. He felt even worse for Jacob. Okay, his brother had struggled with schoolwork, but he had other talents, like his way with horses. Noah started the Land Rover and pulled away, smiling. Jacob had been awesome tonight. Just so long as nothing happened in the next 15 minutes. Chapter 9. Dawn was a glorious affair. Across the fens, the trees in the vast fields of rape took on a green-gold hue, as if they glowed from within. Jackman immersed himself in the moment, absorbing the peace of it. He took several deep breaths. Reluctantly, he turned his back on the vista, walked back to the carport, and unlocked his car. It was no good mooning over a sunrise. He needed a clear head, a strategy, and a loyal and focused team. Well, he had the team. Now he must take care of the rest. The closer he got to Salton Le Fen, the darker his mood became. One dreadful case was enough to contend with, especially since it revolved around psychotic Alistair Ashcroft. But two, both involving killers, was almost too much. As he neared the station, Jackman realized he couldn't continue in his present frame of mind. This was no time to feel sorry for himself. The team needed a tough, decisive leader, not a self-pitying wimp. Suddenly he remembered a detail from Ashcroft's file, something concerning his history. At one point in his younger life, he refused to talk. He remained mute and unreachable until someone had the idea of getting him up on stage. Acting. He became a different person altogether, articulate, animated, and assertive. Maybe the killer Ashcroft had something to teach the policeman. He parked in his usual place and sat in his car to think. It was an amusing thought, but was it so crazy? He couldn't continue as he was, that was for sure. But could he push aside all his fears, doubts, restless nights and terrible dreams, paint on a new face and become the leader his team deserved? If nothing else, he owed it to them to try. He tried to think of a character to base this new persona on, and in the end decided on Jackman, the old Jackman, the man who had risen to Detective Inspector. Jackman stepped from the car, curtain up. Light was streaming through his bedroom window, and Kevin gently disentangled himself from Alan's arms. Remarkably, he had managed to sleep for a few hours. A couple of strong drinks, a few tears, and the strong arms of his patient lover had all worked their magic. The incident was still fresh in his memory, but it had lost its power to frighten him. He was now able to detach himself from the experience, view it like a scene from a movie. Alan stirred, yawned.
"What's the time, babe?"
"Almost 7:30.
What time do you have to be in this morning?" Kevin said.
"I'm doing the late shift to cover for Tim. I'll finish at 10 tonight. Will you be okay till I get home?"
Home. It suddenly sounded so good to Kevin.
"I could be late myself, so no problem. But keep in touch, yeah?"
Alan smiled.
"Of course I will, you donkey. I'm not likely to forget about you, am I?"
He paused.
"Actually, I'm going to be worrying myself sick about you all day. So you ring me too, any time you want, and definitely if you feel a bit shaky."
"Thank you, and thanks for being here for me last night. I'm not sure what I would have done without you."
He sat on the edge of the bed and ran his fingers through Alan's short, fair hair.
"I know what you would have done. You'd have drunk far too many vodkas and passed out, and felt like garbage this morning. Now I feel okay, and that's down to you."
He reached for Alan's hand.
"You are good for me, you know." "Ditto, Kev. We
We are good for each other.
Recently, Kevin had noticed a shift in their relationship. Their initial passionate lust for each other had leveled out and settled into a comfortable companionship. It felt like a permanent thing. He wanted to talk to Alan about moving in together, but wasn't exactly sure if Alan felt the same. However, now was not the time. He stood up. I'll make you a coffee. You get back to sleep while I grab a shower and get off, okay? Got your key? Alan nodded sleepily.
I've always got my key.
Kevin bent down and kissed Alan's forehead.
See you tonight,
he whispered. But Alan was already asleep. As he showered, he wondered what it would be like to live with someone again. He had been alone for so long. Kevin found a clean white uniform shirt and clipped on his black tie. Next week, it would be civvies. He'd already bought two new suits. So, big changes at work. Maybe his private life was also on the brink of a new beginning. Kevin stepped out into a bright new day. Marie and Gary travelled to work separately. There was no way Marie was going to leave her new Tiger in the garage on a morning like this. The journey was short, but it promised to be a delight. Jackman's car was already in the car park. No surprise there. She doubted he'd slept any better than she had. She realized that she was almost dreading seeing his troubled face this morning. She pulled off her helmet and marched into the building, where she bought herself a bit more time changing out of her leathers. She checked her face in the mirror and took a deep breath. She pushed open his door.
Morning, boss.
Ah, Marie. Glad you got here early. I thought we'd hit Harcourt before his Weetabix starts working. What do you say? Marie realized her mouth was open. She closed it and nodded. Jackman wasn't slouched over his desk looking at reports or staring vaguely at his monitor screen. He was pacing the room, notebook and pen in hand. Then, when we are back and the others are in, I want someone to chase up the military medics, see if any of the other local regiments have anyone on file who could be a danger to himself or others. Then we'll do the same with our own people. See if we have a firearms officer in one of the tactical units, maybe SCO-19 or an armed response vehicle officer who has been stood down for stress reasons or was giving cause for concern. Then,
whoa, sir, can we take this one step at a time? I'm still with Harcourt and his Weetabix.
Oh, sorry. He didn't look too apologetic. I just want to make the most of every minute.
Then let's go and interrupt the Harcourt breakfast, shall we?
Jackman's phone rang. While he listened to the caller, Marie saw a slightly puzzled expression cross his face. He told whoever it was that they would be down directly.
Oh, that's convenient. Harcourt is downstairs, asking for us.
No kidding.
She opened the door.
Well, we'd better not keep him waiting.
Harcourt was sitting in an interview room. But this was a different man to the one they had met yesterday. He looked terrible, haggard, unkempt. His hair stood on end and his clothes were creased, as if he'd slept in them. He hadn't shaved. Without so much as a greeting, Harcourt launched straight in.
That incident last night, it's all over the bloody television. You have to tell me, was it another shooting?
Why do you ask, Mr. Harcourt? Said Jackman calmly.
Just answer my question, Detective Inspector. Was it a shooting?
Harcourt was almost shouting. His hands were shaking.
Why are you here, Mr. Harcourt?
Beneath the calm, Jackman's voice had a slight edge to it. Because I'm the one who asks the questions in this room. Now Harcourt sounded almost pleading.
Please, I need to know. Does it have some connection to either me or the gun club?
Murray, would you be kind enough to ask one of the officers outside to get Mr. Harcourt a cup of coffee?
Jackman said. Murray opened the door and asked a young constable outside if he would organize a drink for their interviewee. When this had been done, Jackman sat back in his seat.
Okay, sir. What is this all about? From the beginning, if you don't mind.
I lied to you,
Harcourt said softly.
On both occasions you came to Wits End. The gun that was used to kill Keyes,
I suspect it was mine. I own an L11-5A3, and it was stolen during the break-in.
His voice was almost a whisper.
I see.
Jackman frowned.
And you chose to hide this fact because you don't have a firearms certificate for it.
Harcourt nodded.
It was a souvenir.
Spoils of war? Asked Jackman.
A lot of us had memorabilia, mostly taken from the Americans.
Some of the men brought back AK-47s just to hang on the wall.
In theory, we and our shipping containers were supposed to be checked by the military police, but in reality it rarely happened. We kind of felt entitled.
Harcourt shrugged.
Some of our elite SAS boys brought back bazookas and quad bikes from Afghanistan, all stolen from the US military.
Marie recalled an amnesty some years before that had resulted in all manner of weapons being handed in, from rocket launchers to handguns.
So, tell us about your weapon, sir, she said.
An officer entered carrying 3 mugs of coffee.
Got you and the DI one as well, Serge, said the constable, placing them on the table.
Marie thanked him and waited for him to leave.
Your gun, sir.
I should have had it decommissioned and proofed, but I just never got around to it. I didn't tell anyone about it.
It was personal, part of my old life. I never used it at the club. I did look after it, I cleaned it regularly, and I did shoot it on my own land, but as far as I knew, apart from my immediate family, no one was aware of its existence.
Harcourt slumped in his chair.
Then when you said Keyes had been killed with an L11-5A3, I panicked.
Marie nodded, just as she thought.
But you gave it away when you hesitated over the number of guns you owned.
It was another shooting last night, wasn't it?
Harcourt asked softly. Jackman gave a little shrug.
I'm not at liberty to discuss the incident, sir, but...
He picked up his mug of coffee and stared into it. There was another death. Harcourt closed his eyes and murmured something under his breath. An oath or a prayer?
Who was it, D.I. Jackman?
We haven't identified him yet. He was living rough.
Jackman glanced across to Marie, clearly unsure as to how much to divulge. Marie guessed he was deliberating about whether to mention the handgun in the rucksack. She still couldn't see Kenneth Harcourt as a killer. He was an ex-military man who had illegally brought back a gun as a souvenir. End of story. She returned Jackman's look and nodded.
We have something of a dilemma, sir, and you might be able to help us.
Jackman looked at Harcourt thoughtfully.
Our dead man had a gun in his possession. A handgun.
Harcourt's forehead creased in a frown.
What kind of handgun?
It was a Ruger Speed 6 revolver.
Harcourt blew a breath.
Law enforcement and the military carried those until they were phased out. We know, Marie interjected, which means there must be one hell of a lot of them floating around. We wondered if you knew of anyone, maybe through your club, who owned a Ruger.
There are collectors who use the club regularly, though I really wouldn't know exactly what each one owned.
He paused.
Could you describe the victim?
She did so, as fully as she could, omitting the massive exit wound. Harcourt started. He looked aghast.
Do you know someone of that description, sir? Asked Jackman.
Well, it sounds like Arthur Barnes,
our old armourer at the club, but...
Harcourt faltered.
On the streets, you say?
That's right, said Marie. He was hanging out with the homeless on the waste ground where the incident happened.
The constable at the scene said his street name was Barney, stated Jackman, a new light in his eyes. So it could well be him. We need all the information you have on Arthur Barnes, Mr. Harcourt.
He pushed a pad and pen across to him, starting with his address. Harcourt took out his smartphone and scrolled through the contacts. After a while, he said,
Got it.
But he hasn't lived there for a while. He hesitated, looked up.
Arthur was accused of domestic violence, detectives. I couldn't see it myself. I liked the man. I'd known him since we were teenagers. I trusted him with our guns, for heaven's sake.
But mud sticks, and I suppose none of us knows what goes on behind closed doors. Even so, I was shocked to hear he had been hounded out of his home. Last I heard, he'd been planning to go up north, where his family originally came from.
"Looks like he never made it," said Marie, grimly.
"Would you be up to looking at our dead man, Mr. Harcourt?" asked Jackman. "But I'm warning you, it's not a pretty sight."
Harcourt gave a weak laugh. "I'm an ex-soldier, detective. Yes, I'll look at your man."
Jackman stood up. "I'll ring the mortuary. We'll take you there now." He paused. "And we appreciate your honesty regarding the gun, even if it was a little belated."
"I have no idea why I behaved like that, and I'm truly sorry."
He rubbed his forehead. "I've not functioned well since my daughter was killed, and I'm not making excuses for myself, but I lose my temper easily, and I'm angry, angry all the time."
"It's grief, sir. You have every right to be angry."
Jackman stopped in the doorway and smiled understandingly. "And don't concern yourself about not notifying us about the gun. We won't be making too much of that."
Marie was left alone with Harcourt. "Can you tell me anything else about Arthur Barnes, sir?"
"He was military. SBS. A brave man, but he didn't make the best of marriages."
"Ah, Special Boat Services. They are an elite force, aren't they?"
"Yes, the Royal Navy's SAS," said Harcourt. "Pretty fearless lot."
So why was he frightened?
Surely he would have survived the streets more easily than most. That was one for later.
"Tell me about his marriage."
"Brenda hooked him in because she wanted to be seen with a hunky in a uniform. It was a handsome guy back then. I knew Brenda from childhood. Even as a kid she was a schemer, set great store by looks and possessions. What she didn't bargain for was that Arthur would get injured and be retired out. Like a lot of military personnel, Civvy Street didn't suit him, and things went downhill from then on." He sighed. "He was out of work and couldn't find anything that suited him until I gave him a job at the gun club. He settled with us really well."
Marie made a mental note to follow up the domestic violence aspect as soon as possible. "Sir," she said, "can you think of anyone who would want him dead? Maybe another military man?"
"The man who stole my guns, you mean?"
Marie narrowed her eyes. "Possibly, sir. Although the thief could have stolen them to order, and a different party is using them to kill people."
Harcourt closed his eyes. "Dear Evans, I spent all night going over that question. I have no idea." Jackman entered the room. "Rory is preparing the body for a viewing. We can go straight to the morgue." He looked at Harcourt. "Are you still okay with it?"
Harcourt stood up.
"I must know if it's Arthur. I don't know what this all means or what it's about, but I seem to be in the middle of it, and I want some answers."
"You and me both," thought Marie with feeling.
She looked at her watch. It was not yet 8:30, and they could soon have their dead man identified. Today was turning out to be full of surprises, a strangely reinvigorated Jackman, and an identification that could have taken them days to uncover. What next?
Chapter 10. Alistair Ashcroft had seen the news.
"An incident," they said. "Police have not yet released the details."
Well, well. On top of that death in the car park, Pal Jackman would be a busy man. He bared his perfect teeth in a vulpine smile. Poor old Jackman.
He looked out of his window. Below, a group of children were playing tag. He could hear their squeals of laughter. He wondered what it must be like to play games like that. The games he remembered from his own childhood hadn't been a great deal of fun. He shook his head. He disliked thinking about the past, although there were times when the memories came creeping back of their own accord. He turned away from the window. The present was so much more enjoyable. It was a new day, and he had a lot to do. First, a substantial breakfast, and he knew exactly where to get one. He had people around him now.
people who cared about him. This man they thought they knew. He was liked and respected. Things were going well, for Alistair Ashcroft, at least. Pigs. 6 of them, to be precise. Why, wondered Robbie, when there'd been 2 fatal shootings, did he keep thinking about Farmer Beaton's missing pigs? He sensed it was significant somehow, but he couldn't for the life of him think why. His desk phone rang.
Detective Melton, it's Frank Beaton. I did like you said and spread the word to my friends and the other farms around. I was told there's been another animal theft, this time it were a stallion.
What, a horse? Robbie said, rather densely.
Where from, sir?
Appleyard Farm Stables, just outside Ferndyke Village. Belongs to a Mr. Clare Bullimore, and he is well pissed off, I can tell you. Besides being his breast-breeding stallion, it's his favourite, too.
When was this, Mr. Beaton?
Last night. He's not sure what time exactly.
Can you let me have his number, sir? I'll try and get hold of him as soon as I can, but we are snowed under at present.
Ah, yes, I heard the news. Bad business, that. But...
Robbie understood. It's still a serious theft, sir, and it will be dealt with, I promise you. He scribbled down the number in his notebook. Thanks, Mr. Beaton. Robbie wondered what Jackman would say. Most likely Uniform would pay a call, give the owner an incident number, and it would be shoved on the back burner. Robbie wondered what a breeding horse would cost. Thousands? He really had no idea. Marie hurried into the office.
Success. Positive ID for Barney.
She went to the whiteboard and wrote the name Arthur James Barnes next to the post-mortem photograph of their latest victim.
Excellent, said Robbie. Don't often get that lucky so soon.
He looked towards the door. Is the boss with you?
In his office,
she grinned at him. I think I deserve a coffee. Want one? He shook his head.
No, thanks, Marie. I need a word with Jackman.
He went over and tapped on Jackman's door.
Sorry to bother you, sir, but there's been a horse theft reported.
Jackman's head snapped up.
Where from?
Appleyard Farm, Ferndyke Village.
Clay Bullimore's place.
He's a friend of my mother's. He has a breeding stable there. Nice bloke. Great horses. What happened?
One stallion stolen, sir.
What would you like me to do about it?
Go and see him, of course. Do it now. We've got a lot on today.
Jackman practically shoved him out of the office.
And tell him we'll do all we can to get it back. Oh, and Robbie, I want to know the horse's name, okay?
Outside the office, Robbie stood and stared back at the closed door in bewilderment.
You have the look of a startled gazelle, Robbie.
Marie came up behind him with a coffee in either hand.
The boss, he... Oh, that, yeah. Caught me unawares, too. Well, don't worry too much. I don't think he's on anything. His pupils aren't dilated.
Robbie gawped at her. I had considered the possibility of a changeling, but that usually applies to babies. He saw the merriment in her eyes, but wasn't quite sure how to respond.
I think I'd better go and do as I was told.
And that is? She asked.
Catch me some rustlers.
Bye.
After daily orders, Kevin Stoner went to look for William. He wanted to know if he and the others who had been with him the previous night were all right. He found William in a small cafe tucked away down a back alley in Salton Town. He sat alone, staring into an untouched cup of coffee.
You eaten?
Kevin asked softly. William shook his head slowly. Kevin went to the counter and ordered 2 bacon butties, a Danish and 2 coffees. Kevin took the drinks and the pastry back to the table.
I was worried about you and the others. That was a terrible thing to happen. It really shook me up. So I guess you guys are feeling the same.
William finally looked up.
I've been on the streets a long time, Kev, but I've never seen anything like that. You'd have thought we were in Afghanistan, not Salton, the way that sniper took him out. Just for one horrible moment, I thought I was back in Northern...
He stopped abruptly. The realization suddenly struck Kevin. He knew absolutely nothing about William's past. He had no idea why or how he'd become homeless, who he really was, and even where he came from. Asking had always seemed like an invasion of privacy. So, William was ex-military, just like Barney had been. He looked up as a young waitress placed their food on the table.
Ketchup or brown sauce?
She sounded Eastern European.
Brown sauce, please,
Kevin said. William nodded.
Same for me.
Kevin waited until the sauce was on the table before continuing.
We have a name for him, William, so at least he won't finish up as a John Doe in the mortuary. His name was Arthur, and I'm told he was ex-SBS.
William sat up straight.
No shit. Those guys are tough cookies.
Kevin wasn't going to mention the gun, but he did pose a question.
So, why would one of those tough cookies be so scared at being on the streets?
William gave him a somewhat patronizing smile.
Think about it, Kev. He was off his meds, wasn't he? Now you tell me he's a veteran. Well, neurosis, most likely.
I've seen battle fatigue reduce a seasoned fighting machine to a gibbering wreck, crying like a baby and frightened of the dark. He doused his sandwich in brown sauce and chewed contentedly. Kevin watched him eat. That body, for which he'd paid some insignificant amount, was making a big difference to William's whole day. Then he told himself not to feel guilty. It was William's choice to live this way. William had told him it was preferable to the life he'd left behind.
You and the others disappeared pretty fast last night, Kevin said.
Doesn't do for us street dwellers to hang around when the police are about to turn up. No disrespect to you, Kev, but some of your lot aren't exactly sweetness and light where the homeless are concerned.
He took a gulp of coffee.
Something bad happens, and no one to pin it on, and it's, oh, this guy's a homeless drunk, he'll do, stick it on him.
Kevin couldn't argue with this. He'd seen how some of his colleagues behaved towards the homeless. He stared at his half-eaten sandwich. William had consumed his and was now eyeing the pastry. He pushed his own plate and the pastry towards him.
Go on, you have this. I've got to get back.
William didn't hesitate. He grabbed the pastry, saying,
Before you go, last night you asked about the oil theft, didn't you? I couldn't sleep after what happened, so I spoke to a few people. Do you know a family called Lorimer?
Doesn't ring a bell.
Should it?
Kevin asked.
They're not villains, so you might not have had call to meet them, but they are,
William tapped his temple.
A bit balmy. Unorthodox-like.
He lowered his voice.
You know what happens with old Fenland families. Cousins marry cousins.
He raised an eyebrow.
Let's say you probably won't see any of them on Mastermind.
Kevin took out his notebook and scribbled down the name.
You don't know where they live, do you? Somewhere over Hawker's Fenway. They have an old run-down small holding. They're sort of self-sufficient, or so I'm told.
And it's them who are responsible for the bodged theft.
No idea. Might pay to look in their direction.
William looked innocently at him.
But you never heard it from me.
Kevin closed his notebook.
Thanks, William.
He took a fiver from his pocket. If it turns out to be a viable lead, I'll add another. He stood up and pushed his chair back.
It's unlikely you will, but if you hear anything at all about the shootings, will you ring me?
No, I can do, mate.
Kevin started to protest, then realised.
Ah, what an idiot. A mobile wouldn't last 5 minutes on the streets, would it? Dead right. Kids have been killed for their phones. I can get a message to you, though. But as you say, that kind of shit is serious stuff, and I'm not likely to hear too much about it.
William wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
Appreciate the breakfast, Kev. See you around.
On his way back through the town, Kevin thought about inbreeding.
Surely it doesn't still go on today.
He'd come across a few old Lincolnshire people who had told him that prior to the Second World War, they had lived in isolated villages with no transport services. They had no cars back then, so where did you go to meet a likely spouse? As far as a bicycle or horse ride would take you.
And what happened when the neighbouring families were all spoken for? What then? Cousins married cousins. It was a different world now, of course. But in some lonely backwater hamlets, the legacy lingered, and you could see the results in the children. Kevin was eager to see the Lorimers for himself, but it was Charlie Button's case. He'd give the kid the tip-off, let him take the credit, but he'd ask Charlie if he could go along too. Rosie Cohen had spent the last 2 hours trying to find details of military personnel who'd been relieved of their duties due to stress or disability. It had not been easy. No one had been prepared to talk to her. Doctors declared themselves unable to discuss the people under their care, so she kept hitting brick walls. Luckily for her, one or two had engaged in antisocial behaviour that had brought them to public notice. 2 men and 1 woman, to be specific, had presented serious cause for concern in recent years. She had copies of the records of these 3 possibles and read them through again. They were Jeremy Freeman, former Marine, Lewis Smith, ex-Army rifleman, and Bethany Gadd, one-time police officer. All had been expert marksmen. All were damaged in some way. Now she could hand the records to Jackman for him to deal with. Thank God that was done. It was hard to concentrate when she had come to work this morning, leaving Tim and Jessica, her beloved twins with ear infections. The symptoms were relatively mild, so Max was keeping an eye on them. She didn't need to worry. Max had gone from being a nervous wreck to super dad, almost overnight, and had thrown himself wholeheartedly into the task of parenthood. This was helped by the fact that he had a magic touch with a crying baby, and in fact was much better at it than she was. Still, it was a constant struggle to balance policing and parenting. When they were at work, they wanted to be at home with the twins and vice versa. Here, too, Max seemed to do better than she did. It wasn't helping that they now had a sniper on the loose, as well as the sinister figure of Alistair Ashcroft waiting to strike. Rosie yawned. It was all a bit too much. Marie and Gary were busy investigating the married life of Arthur James Barnes, an elite naval commando who had once lived according to the motto, by strength and guile. Gary knew a great deal more about the special boat service than her, and Marie had learnt that apart from their extraordinary prowess as swimmers, divers, and canoeists, they were highly skilled at engaging in underwater demolitions and maritime counter-terrorism. "He deserves a proper investigation," stated Gary. "No matter what we dig up, the mere thought of a man like that being on the streets and scared is simply unthinkable." Privately, Marie wondered how many others were in the same state. Not everyone received the level of care that they deserved, even if they were heroes. Even so, she agreed with Gary. She handed him a sheet of paper. "That's all I know so far. You see what you can find out about the wife herself. I'll run a check on the report of domestic violence and see if the police were involved." It didn't take Marie long to discover that they had been called on several occasions. Each time, no one was prepared to press charges, so no further police action was taken. She noticed a comment made by one of the attending uniformed constables that the domestic setup seemed a bit odd. In her opinion, the wife seemed more like the aggressor than the husband. Marie read the name of the officer concerned and remembered that she had seen her at the crime scene of the shooting the night before. Marie rang down to the back office. Luckily, PC Hazel Stewart was on shift that morning, out in the yard cleaning her vehicle. Marie headed off to find her. Hazel thought for a while.
"Yeah, I do remember her. Very weird, that particular shout. I actually got the feeling that it had all been staged, you know, like play acting." She paused, frowning. "All except the husband. And I got the feeling he was on something. He seemed spaced out. He definitely didn't come across as if he'd just behaved as aggressively as the wife and her friend had said he did." "Her friend?" "Yeah, this other woman was there, and giving it plenty of mouth, too." Hazel pulled a face. "Between the two of them, I finished up feeling quite sorry for Arthur Barnes. He looked more like the victim than the wife." "That's interesting," said Marie. "A close friend of his said he wasn't the type to go in for that kind of violence."
As I said, it all looked like a setup and no one wanted to take things further, so we just walked away in the end. Puzzled me, though. Hazel wrung out the cloth she'd been using and hung it over the side of the bucket. I was shocked to hear he'd finished up on the streets and then got murdered like that. I can only think it had something to do with drugs. I did think he was on something when we went to his house. He was ex-military, so maybe after coming out of the services he'd just never settled, suggested Marie. Why don't you talk to Kevin Stoner about that, Sarge? He's been talking to a snout about Barnes. She found Kevin by the vending machine, muttering threats and curses. Bloody thing, it's just swallowed another pound coin. It should have an Asbo slapped on it. Marie walked round the machine and gave it a hefty thump. There was an immediate whirring noise, and a small handful of cash and a chocolate bar fell into the drawer. Kevin looked at her in awe. Respect, Sarge, nice one. She smiled sweetly at him. In return, you can fill me in on what your snout told you about Arthur Barnes.
Snout? Oh, you mean William?
Well, not much, other than his thoughts on why he might be on the streets and in the state he was.
And that was what?
Well, Sarge, like a lot of veterans, especially injured or traumatised ones, they finish up on serious medication. He was pretty certain that Barney was off his meds and suffering from paranoia. That would account for his excessive fear and his belief that he was being threatened.
Very true.
Except for the fact that someone really was out to kill him, and they succeeded.
Good point, Kevin sighed.
But I'll bet meds show up in the post-mortem. He pocketed his change. Is Charlie Button in the CID room, Sarge?
He was when I left.
Then I'll come back with you if you don't mind. I'd like a word with him. Kevin fell into step with her. I wonder what we are looking at with these shootings. This sniper doesn't seem like anything I've read about in old cases. Shootings are usually mayhem, aren't they, Sarge? Mass killings or else a clear target, as in the assassination of a spy. Marie nodded. I agree, and we can't think of anything that might link Christopher Keyes and Arthur Barnes, other than being shot in the head by our sniper. For a moment, Kevin's step faltered.
Sorry, Kev, that was really thoughtless of me. I've not even asked how you are today. What a callous cow I am. My mother would give me hell.
Kevin laughed. I'm good, honestly. It was simply shock. And that's wearing off all the time.
Charlie's over at the photocopier.
Marie pointed across the office. See you later. Marie watched him go. It was going to be no bad thing to have Kevin Stoner as part of their CID complement.
Sarge, got a minute?
Gary called to her. She went over to his desk, pulled up a spare chair and sat down.
What have you got?
Quite a bit of hearsay and a load of supposition, but beneath all the smoke and mirrors, I think Brenda Barnes was having an affair and was using her new lover's sister to back up her allegation that Arthur was violent towards her. Gary stared at his screen.
I reckon she drove Arthur out just so that she could be with her new man.
Poor sod. And after all he went through, he had no luck at all, did he?
She paused.
Hang on. Where did you get all that from, Gary? Sounds more like Coronation Street than the police national computer.
My sister's best friend, Julie, still lives a few doors away from the Barnes house. I rang her and got the lowdown from the neighbours. Neat, huh?
Very. So can you tell me what he did to get assassinated?
Gary looked apologetic.
Sorry, neighbourhood watch doesn't go that far.
Marie leaned back in her chair.
You know something? I think we're wasting our time. I'm beginning to wonder if the victims are just red herrings to keep us occupied when we should really be looking for the shooter.
Rose is on that, said Gary. She's checking out sharpshooters who have been decommissioned because of mental health problems.
Well, I don't envy her. The military are notoriously tight-lipped when it comes to discussing their failures. But maybe that's another red herring. My money's on the gun club.
You could be right, Gary said.
Uniform are on the ground, gathering up names and taking statements from members. They were onto it immediately after you had your visit from Mr. Harcourt. They've promised to flag up anything of interest.
Keep an eye on that, Gary.
anything even the slightest bit interesting, and we'll go ourselves, okay?
Gary nodded.
I'll keep you updated.
Murray stood up.
Just going to check in with the boss.
She stopped and added,
Have you spoken to him this morning, Gary?
Not yet. Why?
Oh, nothing. Just wondered.
Chapter 11. After leaving Mill Corner, Laura Archer had gone directly to Greenborough Police Station to help assess a prisoner in custody, a woman who was exhibiting signs of mental distress. It hadn't taken her long to discover that the whole thing was a scam. It was around 10:30 when she finally got to her consulting room. The place was no longer home. It was just where she worked. She belonged at Mill Corner now. It gave her a comfortable feeling. She went first to her apartment to check everything was okay. She hadn't been in for several days and was wondering if she'd left any milk in the fridge. Her consulting rooms on the ground floor were completely self-contained with a tiny galley kitchenette and a separate toilet. She wondered whether she should rent the flat out. It was well cared for and modern and in a good location, so it could fetch top money. But would she be pushing Jackman into committing himself when he might not be ready? She didn't want to tempt fate, then find herself with nowhere to go.
Don't rush things, Laura, she whispered,
and then laughed. Ever the counsellor. The key to her consulting room door refused to turn. She pulled it out and looked at it. Yes, it was the right one. She tried again, and this time it worked.
Must get that oiled, she muttered, opening the inner door to her office.
Her main consulting room was designed to foster a sense of calm. It smelled of aromatherapy oils and had a clever color-change system of lighting that relaxed the mind. Her desk was in one corner of the room, the center of which was occupied by two comfortable leather recliners, and this was where she conducted her sessions with her clients. Laura went to her desk to get the case file that she required, then stopped mid-stride. In the center of the desk, in a china pot, was a pure white orchid.
Jackman. What a lovely thought, she murmured, smiling.
He was the only other person with a key, so it had to be him. Then she saw the card and opened it eagerly. My dear Laura, such a lovely room. I'm in awe. Go to your computer and open videos, and I'll tell you more.
Alistair.
Laura saw that her hand was shaking. She dropped the card as if it were covered in acid and stared at it.
Alistair Ashcroft. Here.
She pulled her phone from her pocket, found Jackman's number. Then she cancelled the call. Hesitantly, she lifted the lid of her laptop. Before she touched the keys, she looked closely. The whole thing had been carefully wiped with an astringent-smelling cleanser. It looked as good as new. She switched it on and waited for it to load. She needed to see this before she spoke to Jackman. She clicked videos, and a new MOV file was waiting for her. Laura swallowed.
Here goes.
A man was seated in a high-backed chair, his face in shadow. Laura adjusted the volume and listened.
Laura Archer, I really must congratulate you.
You have a wonderful room. I've been in many consulting rooms in my time, but yours... Alistair Ashcroft gave a small, controlled laugh. Even I might be persuaded to share some of my secrets with you in a room such as this. I am sorry that we aren't speaking face to face, but maybe another time. Yes, another time. Very soon. We will talk frankly. He shifted slightly, and light caught the arm of the chair he was sitting on. Laura paused the footage and stared at the image frozen on the screen. It was her chair. He was filming this right here in her room. She was overcome with fear and outrage. The mere thought that he had been here, contaminating her sanctuary, made her want to vomit. She started the video again, forcing herself to listen to his insidious voice. "Now, I know you will be itching to ring Jackman and tell him about this, but perhaps you might reconsider. You're an intelligent woman and will know more than anyone, except possibly Marie Evans, just how what is happening has affected him. You will think, do I want to be the one to cause him to fall apart? If he knows for certain that you're being watched by Alistair Ashcroft, it will send him into free fall. Do you want to do that to the man you love?" He shifted again. The darkness hid his face, but he was gloating. "I'm right, am I not? He is suffering, Laura. Last night, for instance, standing there by the old mill tower, brooding and troubled, a dark silhouette against the even darker night sky." Laura's mouth went dry. She paused the video again. He'd been out there, watching Jackman. He could have killed him. And had he been there when Jackman left to go to the shooting incident and she was alone? Her legs trembled, grew weak. She sank into her office chair and stared in horror at the screen. Where was this going? Now, if I'd been that sniper he is chasing, he would have been right in the crosshairs, wouldn't he? He really shouldn't make himself into a target like that. He stopped. Enough of this. Enjoy your orchid. We'll meet properly when things are less hectic. And, Laura, do think carefully. Won't you? The screen went black. Laura closed her eyes and exhaled. Ashcroft was right. Her initial reaction had been to tell Jackman and show him the video, get a socko in and dust the whole office and especially that lock. But could she do it? She remembered that nightmare. Jackman hadn't needed to tell her that it visited him regularly. He saw Marie die in front of him probably several times a day. Then there was the stress he was under, his constant anxiety about the people he loved and cared for. He knew that all those connected to him were in immediate danger until he could catch and incarcerate Ashcroft. Where Ashcroft was concerned, Jackman was as vulnerable as a child. The competent and compassionate psychotherapist was suddenly at a loss. She took hold of the china pot with the orchid in it and hurled it against the wall and howled in rage. "Thought I'd ring in person, just in case you were missing my sparkling wit and mordant humour," Rory said. Marie smiled. "Who is this, please?" she replied, trying to sound officious. "Titania, Queen of the Fairies."
"Thought so," Marie chuckled. "So, what have you got for us, Prof?" "I have absolutely nothing, dear heart, but my very able assistant has worked out where the sniper was and some information on the gun and ammunition. I shall hand you over to him forthwith."
The spike who took the phone sounded very different to the funky, spiky-haired young mortuary assistant who'd gone to work with Rory all that time ago. Seemed Rory had been right to keep him on. "Sergeant Evans, there are identical marks on the casings of the bullets, which confirms that it was the same gun that fired the shot at Christopher Keyes. But as I suspected from the damage done to Arthur Barnes, he used a different bullet, a hollow point, often referred to as a dum-dum."
"Why would he do that?" asked Marie.
"They are mainly used for their stopping power. They expand on impact, hence the bigger wound, but because they slow down as they travel through soft tissue, they are less likely to pass through the target and hit something or someone else." Spike paused. "But I think he used it because it's pretty lethal."
"Rory said you've calculated the location of the shooter," Marie said.
"Once we had daylight, it was simple," Spike said confidently. "He had taken up position on the footbridge over the drain. It's rarely used, as the land on the other side of the water is fenced off. They're about to begin a new housing project. It gave him the height and a perfect view of the old storeroom. I took a telescopic lens over there and looked for myself, and it was a clear line of sight."
"And the sockles have gone over the spot, I assume?"
"Thoroughly, but nothing was found. It seems he's very careful," Spike said.
"Isn't he just?"
murmured Marie.
"Thank you, Spike.
The prof wants another word, Sergeant.
Rory was speaking again.
Dum-dums. You're dying to ask why they're called that, are you not? And don't lie now, I know you are.
You got me, I admit it. As far as I'm concerned, it's one of life's great mysteries. Go on, Rory, educate me.
Because the inventor, Lieutenant Colonel Neville Snaid Bertie Clay, was the superintendent of the British arsenal at Dumdun in Bengal, and that's where they were first produced. Now, isn't that interesting?
Riveting. You have made my day, Rory. Now, please, can I go and catch some bad guys?
That's what they pay you for. Off you toddle, dear lady. Ta-ta for now.
Marie had worked with numerous pathologists in her time. Some talked down to you. Some seemed to speak another language, it was so technical. And others were plain creepy. Some never talked at all. Rory Wilkinson and his humour were a panacea for the sorrow, the horror of death. Apart from which, he was the best pathologist she'd ever come across.
Marie, got a minute, please?
Jackman beckoned her into his office. Inside, she found Charlie Button already there. Charlie has a lead on the diesel theft, and considering it wasn't a textbook heist to say the least, we are thinking that it could be linked to Robbie's pig-stealing gang. Jackman flopped down into his captain's chair. Both efforts were rough around the edges, to say the least.
As was the gun theft, added Marie, remembering the axed-off door lock and the shattered gun cabinet.
Could it be the same gang?
Jackman shrugged. I wouldn't rule it out. Those guys were heavy-handed in the extreme.
Marie looked at Charlie.
Anyone we know in the spotlight?
Well, I've made a few discreet inquiries. This lot aren't known to us, but they are an odd bunch.
Charlie looked at her.
An old Fenn family, name of Lorimer.
Marie laughed.
Lorimer? Rachel Lorimer's boys?
Oh, my. Now, if anyone was going to embark on a life of crime and balls it up, it would be the Lorimers.
Jackman and Charlie glanced at each other. You seem to know them rather well, Jackman said.
My dad knew the grandfather, Caleb Lorimer. He was a blacksmith and a farrier, and he used to make all sorts of stuff in metal, wrought iron and the like. He was a talented man, but uneducated. They hailed from right out on Hawker's Fen, miles from anywhere.
That's right, Hawker's Fen, Charlie nodded. Not somewhere I've ever been.
Very few have, said Marie. It's at the bottom of a long straight drove that goes on for miles and miles and ends nowhere. The only place close to it is Thatcher's Fen village, and all that has is a church and a village hall. No other amenities at all.
Other family trouble? Asked Jackman.
Not trouble in the criminal sense, other than poaching and generally doing things their way. Marie tried to remember their names.
Rachel was Caleb's eldest daughter. She married a second cousin and has four sons and one daughter. All have biblical names.
Jackman grinned. Please don't tell me they are Matthew, Mark, Luke and John.
This was another Jackman, a relaxed and almost chirpy one. It was rather disconcerting, but it was a hell of a lot better than the other version.
I remember one was called Noah and another Levi, but I don't recall the rest.
And every one of Caleb's grandchildren had a disability of one sort or another, mainly learning difficulties. The tiny village school couldn't cope with the disruption they caused, and getting them to a bigger school wasn't possible because they had been barred from using the school bus, so they lost out completely on an education.
Marie could hear her father now.
That poor Caleb had his work cut out with his children, all bar Rachel. She's got her head screwed on by the others. The original wild bunch. God help us if they ever have kids of their own.
And, of course, they did. I was about to send Charlie, Jackman said. Since you have some knowledge of the family, Marie, would you go with him?
Sure, at least I know where they live. No offence, Charlie, but you could be driving around until nightfall looking for their place.
She turned to Jackman.
Should we go now?
Absolutely. If we can dig up something to work on and get this small stuff cleared, then we'll be free to concentrate on the serious issues.
Ah, talking of serious issues, boss.
Marie quickly filled him in on what Spike had told her, omitting Rory's contribution.
Okay, well, I've pulled in a couple of pool detectives to help out with following up the gun club members and any other locals with firearms licenses. I'll keep them beavering away on that while you try to get us a lead on these botched jobs, all right?
Marie threw Charlie an amused smile. Okay, Button, prepare to meet the Fenlands' answer to Shameless.
Sounds interesting.
That's one way of putting it.
They left Jackman's office and made their way down to pick up the keys to a CID car.
Sarge, is it all right with you if we take Kevin Stoner with us?
To tell you the truth, it was him that found this lead for me, and he said he'd like to get a look at the Lorimers. He's never come across the family before, and he's quite interested.
So that was what Kevin had been talking to his snout William about.
I would say no problem, but I don't want to put Rachel Lorimer on the defensive by bringing a big crowd. She can be very protective of her boys, and I'm not sure how she'll react to seeing a police uniform.
No worries, Sarge. I'll just tell him that before we go, if that's okay, Charlie asked.
Oh, damn it, let him come, Charlie. Rachel Lorimer will at least take us seriously if there's a uniform with us, and it could scare one of her boys into giving something away. Go and see if he's free while I get hold of a vehicle. I'll see you in the car park.
Chapter 12. Sam Page had always known that retiring wouldn't mean giving up. You didn't spend your entire working life trying to assuage the anguish of damaged minds, only to switch off completely when a certain date on the calendar came around. Initially, he had tried to do just that. He had bought his lovely little cottage next to the marsh and had devoted every waking hour to his beloved hobby of nature watching. His garden was a glorious wilderness of plants and flowers and provided a haven for all manner of birds and animals, and he loved it. He also made plans to do all the things he had never found time for when working. Recently, however, he'd found his thoughts increasingly returning to psychology. It could have something to do with Laura Archer. She had been his star pupil, and throughout her subsequent career had continued to stay in touch with him. She could have been a real high flyer, rising to the position of senior lecturer at one of the best universities. She could have made a fortune as a private consultant. Instead, Laura had turned her back on all that and continued to work at grassroots level. She was now the Fenland Constabulary's on-call psychologist. Though slightly uncomprehending, Sam was pleased. He had moved to the fens, close to the marsh, so that he could spend time studying the migrant water birds that fascinated him so much. It also meant that he was able to see her regularly. Laura had become the daughter he'd never had, and he couldn't have been more delighted when she and Rowan Jackman finally decided to make a go of it. He just wished there was no dark shadow over their happiness. But until they caught Jackman's old nemesis, they would have no peace. Sam sat on his patio sipping tea and watching for birds out on the marsh. It seemed inconceivable that one man could evade an entire police force, all of whom were focused on bringing him down. Most worrying to him was that both his precious Laura and D.I. Jackman were clearly in the killer's sights. His mobile